Get growing with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 and KSTE.com. Here is Fred Hoffman.
And a happy Sunday morning to you. Welcome to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE. Farmer Fred here. How you doing? Don't breathe too deeply. The air is, shall we say, a little smoky. Again, hazy skies today, hazy skies on Monday. But some good news. I've been getting reports that there is a westerly wind developing in the Bay Area, which means maybe that smoke will get cleared out later today, maybe on Monday. It's a possibility. So welcome to the indoor garden edition of Get Growing today. We'll be talking with Don Shore from Redwood Barn Nursery coming up in a few minutes. I am Farmer Fred Hoffman, UC Cooperative Extension Lifetime Master Gardener, garden columnist with the Lodi News Sentinel, the guy that does all the typing at FarmerFred.com, all the ranting at the Farmer Fred Rant blog page at Twitter.com/FarmerFred, daily snark, daily garden tips. What else is there? Instagram, YouTube, Pinterest, Strava. Man, I am just so ticked off. I mean, the one thing that ticks me off is when I can't ride my bike. And all this smoke has limited me to 60 miles on the bike this week, 61 miles, I think, to be exact. I like to do 100 miles a week, and it's just too smoky. It's time to order the indoor trainer, I think. I hope this isn't the new normal, but considering the early start to fire season in California, maybe this is the new normal now. Air quality in our region today, as you know, is very poor. Looking at the sparetheair.com, three pages I look at for smoke to determine how much outdoor activity to do. Three pages I look at include purpleair.com, sparetheair.com, and airnow.gov. And taking a look at the current situation as far as the air quality index, I got to tell you, it is better now than it was 2 hours ago. It is still from Sacramento to Lake Tahoe. It is still bad air. It's unhealthy air with readings between 200 and 300. That's considered unhealthy air in our region. It's a health alert for that everyone may experience more serious health effects if they're exposed for 24 hours or more. It's a cumulative thing. And considering we've been breathing smoke for now close to a month, you're probably feeling it in your throat. But anyway, as I said, this morning, there were a lot of readings in the 300s. Now it's mostly in the 200s. I am hoping it will drop. And according to airnow.gov, they do a little forecast page, and they're predicting unhealthy air today at a reading of 187 as far as the smoke goes, the particulate matter 2.5. A little better tomorrow, 169, but still considered hazardous. And that's in the red zone. And then it drops Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday into the orange zone, which is unhealthy for sensitive groups. What is a sensitive group? Well, a sensitive group would be if you have pre-existing conditions, people with lung or heart issues, older adults, small children, asthma, things like that. You need to take precautions. For the rest of us, just take it a little easier. For instance, when the sky is orange, when it's unhealthy for sensitive groups, when the readings are 100 to 150, I avoid hill work on the bike. I try to just stick to the flatlands so as not to be breathing too heavily. So maybe this week with the unhealthy air for sensitive groups getting down to as low as 112 on Thursday and maybe better as the week goes on, we can get some hill work in and get back to work in the garden. We're trying to transition from the summer garden to the fall garden, and all this smoke is making it that much more difficult. But maybe from your window, you can take a look at your garden and you can see which plants are performing and which are not. The ones who are not, especially those summer annuals, the summer vegetables that may be done, that may be suffering, time for them to go. Time to pick up some cool season flowers and vegetables. We're going to be talking with Don Shore in a few minutes from Redwood Barn Nursery. I'm sure he'll have some ideas on that, as well as about cat-safe indoor plants. Don was mentioning that students are back at UC Davis and they've been coming into the nursery looking for houseplants and want to know which houseplants are safe for me and my cats. It's a good question. I want to know what you're doing back at school. Why are you sitting at home in front of a computer bugging your parents? Really? Well, I guess it's maybe just graduate students that are back. I'm not sure. But you kids take it easy, okay? Wear your mask, social distancing, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Right now I can hear them. They're shouting, "Shut up, old man. Leave me alone." All right. So air continues. The fires continue, too. That's the thing. And looking at the latest statewide fire summary, it's something like 29 wildfires across California. God bless the firefighters. There's over 16,000 now working to gain containment. Firefighters across the state responded to 36 new wildfires just yesterday. They, though, were quickly contained. But since the beginning of the year, wildfires have burned over 3.3 million acres in California. Not quite as large as Connecticut, which is 3.5 million acres, but certainly larger than Delaware. 22 fatalities, 4,100 structures destroyed, and a lot of the major fires are within our breathing zone. Good news is the fires that we've been talking about the last few weeks, the LNU Lightning Complex, the SCU Lightning Complex, and the CZU Lightning Complex. Oh, I love acronyms. Are pretty much well contained. The LNU fire of Napa, Lake, Sonoma, Colusa, Solano, and Yolo counties, 96% contained. The SCU Complex fire of Contra Costa, Alameda, Santa Clara, San Joaquin, Merced, and Stanislaus counties, that is 98% contained. The CZU Lightning Complex fire of San Mateo and Santa Cruz counties, 87% contained. But then there are fires that need more containment, like the Creek Fire in Fresno County, 201,000 acres, but only 8% contained. There are bigger fires like that August Complex in Tehama County, which has burned 877,000 acres. That's only 24% contained. And there's other scattered fires around as well. So the smoke will continue unless the wind can figure out a place to send it that isn't on us. Don't know where that will be yet. We're kind of surrounded. But hopefully we can get to the point where when we look at these color-coded maps of air quality, we'll start seeing more yellow and green and not purple, red, and orange. We can only hope. A little bit later on in the program, we will have a garden grappler, a chance for you to pick up a prize or two from the Farmer Fred Prize Closet. By the way, if we haven't mentioned it yet, don't forget to wash off the ash, not only from your car, but also from your plants. It has been said that ash-covered plant on the leaves can reduce photosynthesis by 50%. That's not a good thing. So wash off the tops of the leaves, wash off the bottoms of the leaves. And then any harvestable items, the leafy greens especially, because of all the crinkles in the leaves, wash them thoroughly when you bring them indoors. And that includes tomatoes and peppers as well. All right. It's interesting weather, to say the least. It's not hot, at least. Right now, 71 degrees here in the Butuan Jungle in suburban Purgatory. Downtown Sacramento right now, it's not bad at all, really. What is it, 64 degrees at Mather? Executive Airport, excuse me. That's a little closer to downtown than Mather. 64, but hazy and smoky. That would be much below normal. So it was a good way to break the heat wave we've been having. All right. It wasn't a good way to break the heat wave, but at least it broke the heat wave. It just hurts to breathe now. But it looks like temperatures for the coming week will be, for the most part, in the 80s. That's good news. Maybe we'll get clear skies, or at least clearer skies. And overnight lows, very pleasant. In the low to mid 60s, if only we could open up the windows at night. Well, maybe we will be as the week progresses and the weather starts cooperating. So we'll see. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we're talking with Don Shore from Redwood Barn Nursery in Davis and get some indoor gardening ideas as we continue with Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE. We'll be right back.
Fred, Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Let's bring in Don Shore from Redwood Barn Nursery in Davis, where they're open just about every day of the year, except for what, 2 days, Don?
We are open 362 days a year.
Oh, 3 days.
Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's Day.
There you go. And you will be there despite the smoke at 12 noon today.
Correct.
All right,
washing
Don Shore.
Washing plants off.
Yeah, that's an important part. We talked about that, the importance of getting the ash off the plants. And I would think in a nursery, that would be something you would be doing probably twice a day.
One day we did it four times, and we were watching the flakes continue to fall as we did it. So it felt kind of futile, but the plants appreciate it.
Yeah, and it does make them look pretty, too, all that dripping water. Speaking of dripping water, let's tackle some email that people have been sending to Fred at FarmerFred.com, and I'm sure they will call in with questions as well, 866-331-8255 or 916-576-1578. But Willie writes in and says, we have a terrible case of powdery mildew on our zucchini. We'll be pulling them out to make way for our winter garden. What's the best way to rid it in our soil so we can plant some new plants there? That's an interesting thought that it might be soil borne.
I don't think it is. I think the key is to get rid of all the zucchini leaves, the zucchini plant. And sure, you can compost that if you actually have a functioning compost pile that reaches a sufficient internal temperature. Most people don't. So perhaps sending it off in that green bin that goes off to be composted by the municipality you live in might be more suitable. I wouldn't worry too much about it being soil-borne.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a thorough cleanup and next year plant mildew-resistant varieties.
Yeah, also, it's just part of the late-season thing with those. I mean, mildew showed up a few days ago, about a week ago. As I mentioned on the other show, we hit the dew point, and that means there's moisture on the leaves in the morning. People listening to your podcast back east may not understand this phenomenon. We don't have dew here from about May 1, typically till the end of September. It happened a little early this year, and that dew allows the mildew to get going. But, you know, it's the end of the season for those plants, so it's really not that big an issue. People have a problem with mildew on some of their vegetables. It generally means they're in too much shade or there's not good air circulation. Out in an open garden, it shouldn't be a problem in terms of yield and productivity.
Yeah, people back east may be aghast the fact that our afternoon humidity levels are in the teens.
Yeah. During the heat wave, we had one day at 4 p.m. when the humidity was 5%.
Oh, ooh, okay.
Those are Death Valley numbers.
Yeah, exactly. There have been record-breaking temperatures throughout the state this past summer. I think in Woodland Hills, down in the San Fernando Valley, they hit 121 degrees one day last week.
And that's it's Death Valley level two.
Yeah, exactly. And okay, maybe it's the new normal. But zucchini and powdery mildew seem to go together this time of year.
And you notice it on some of your flowers as well. Verbena is going to start showing it. Their season's kind of done. So I don't worry too much about late season mildew. In the vegetable garden, I think it gets back to doing that cleanup, which has a lot of benefits anyway, getting all the plants out and away. And if you're an actual avid composter, you're going to grind them up and put them in your compost bin, and you're going to have a thermometer that tells you the internal temperature of that compost pile is, what, 165 degrees. Do you do this, Fred?
Well, I do a lot of monitoring. Let's put it that way.
Those of us on rural properties just throw things in a heap down at the further end of the vegetable garden and try to get them away from, let them break down.
Yeah, exactly. It's when we lived in Harold, we had what I like to call the passive compost pile. Others would say it's just a vegetable mountain.
Right. As long as there's moisture and it's not a burn pile, you're fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, well. Now, you have students coming back to. I still can't figure out why students are coming back to UC Davis. I guess it's the Cal State University system that's saying stay home, watch your computer, whereas at Davis they're saying come on in, we're having a party.
Well, it was interesting. A lot of landlords wouldn't void the leases that people had signed in back in the spring, so that's part of it. And they are doing some in-person classes on campus, though for the most part it is distance learning. But according to the Davis Enterprise, 50% of undergraduates and 70% of graduate students are returning. And although only about a quarter of the expected number are on campus in the dorms, which allows them each to have their own room, by the way, yeah. That's pretty cool, they're coming back and they're coming in and they're buying house plans and they're going to be spending a lot of time sitting at their computers in their apartments and dormitories instead of actually going to lecture halls. So they're buying house plans, which is cool. And they're interestingly on edge about everything, as everybody else is. So I think the house plants are probably a better habit than drinking. And in some cases, just as compulsive. So we're getting a lot of questions from these absolutely novice houseplant gardeners. And if you have a kid that's gone off to college, it probably would be a pretty cool thing to give them, just because they're going to be spending a lot more time in their rooms than your average college student would have in the past.
Well, Don, that's a theory.
Yes.
That they'll spend more time in their rooms.
We hope so. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
The campus
okay.
is pretty rigorous. Yeah, there we go. So anyway, they'll be looking at those houseplants more than normal. Let's put it that way.
All right. Now, some of them are going to bring cats along for company.
Yes. Every single day, at least once a day, we get the question, which of your houseplants are safe for my kitty? And these are college students, so I want to have an intelligent conversation about relative risk assessment and degrees of toxicity, and they get this kind of glazed expression. What I realize what they really want is, what are plants that are absolutely safe for my kitty? So unfortunately, that rules out a lot of the ones that we like to steer them towards, like ZZ plants and snake plants and pothos and philodendron, because if you go to the ASPCA houseplant list, you'll find those are listed mm-hmm. as toxic. They contain a toxin.
Yep. By the way, before we go on, let's clear up, because people may be wondering what you said. And you did say ZZ plant, like in ZZ Top, only it's ZZ yep. plant. And it really is, which stands for?
Zamia coulcus, Zamia folia.
There you go.
In half an hour.
Zippity doo dah. Yes.
Easy ZZ has become very popular because it can grow in low light. You can literally go weeks between waterings and it will forgive you. It's right up there with snake plant, the Sansevieria, as being one of those virtually indestructible indoor plants. Unfortunately, the leaves do contain a slight toxin. I don't think a cat could ever eat enough for that to be a concern, but that's not the conversation that we end up having. So it's a great choice in many cases, as long as people are okay with the fact that if the cat bites it, the cat will show some irritation. My kids, when they were young, ate a peace lily, okay? I don't know how many parents out there had this experience, but we came in and found they had taken our spathiphyllum, turned it into a solid, and were eating it. And so we called the Poison Control Center. They didn't yet know us on a first-name basis, but it was close. And their comment was, watch them. If their mouths get irritated, you may wish to alleviate that. Okay, not like rush them to the hospital because they're going to be very sick. Just it might cause some irritation. And in fact, it didn't cause any. So there was, I have to express that they may contain a toxin, but that doesn't mean that they're particularly dangerous. However, I have a list of perfectly safe plants for cats, such as Creeping Charlie. Swedish ivy, same name, a couple different plants that are very similar. Palms in general, peperomias, which are popular right now, very trendy, actually. Spider plant, can't go wrong with spider plant. Easy to grow, grows in almost any situation, and apparently non-toxic to cats. And then most of the succulents that you might happen to try and grow indoors, like jade plant, are actually fine as well. Although aloe vera, which people often grow indoors, actually can be toxic to your cat. And I'll come back to Boston fern, because that one is a popular, although a little fussy, indoor plant. It is apparently safe for cats as well. The one that I mention a lot, and then I have to give a little feedback on, is the calathea or calatheas, which are becoming really popular because of the cool leaves, zebra plant, rattlesnake plant. These are relatives of the prayer plant. And they do contain something that might cause a little dermatitis, but that's it. So they're on the, I put them on the list, and I just warn them that that might be something where the cat will bite it and shake his head and not bite it again, we hope. So those are some that are considered basically perfectly safe. Then the others, you get into degrees of toxicity. If a cat bites a pothos leaf, you probably won't even notice it, except for the damage to the pothos leaf. So peace lilies, apparently the same category.
My concern now is of those college students who have listened to what you just said, but they were busy constructing a beer can pyramid in their window and maybe didn't hear you totally clearly. But we should point out that you mentioned Swedish ivy and grape ivy, yeah. But we should point out not ivy ivy.
Right, regular old English ivy, which, by the way, is a terrible house plant anyway because it always gets spider mites. But it's often sold as an indoor plant. And, in fact, there's one of the sororities in town that used it as a pledge week thing. I had all these girls, one after another, coming in asking if we had ivy. And I finally realized this thing they were doing was they had to be able to care for an ivy plant for a fixed period of time or they wouldn't qualify for the sorority. Bad choice because it always gets spider mites. It's also toxic to cats. So that's one to mention. As not being safe. This is the problem with common names, you know, because Swedish ivy isn't an ivy. It's a plectranthus. It's in the same group as Creeping Charlie in the mint family. And so it's perfectly safe.
Yeah. And English ivy is what? Hedera helix?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not as pretty as the variegated, the Algerian ivy. But again, that's ivy as well.
Yeah, so that's not going to be one that I'd want them buying if they want them to be perfectly safe. There's also, I should mention, the Creeping Charlie. Yeah, we all grew that in the dorms back in the Dark Ages, and it was actually a great choice, as were the things that the general category we call Wandering Jew, the Zabrinas and the Tradescantias and all that crowd. One thing about them is they can go really dry and recover from it. So we have this overlap of easy to grow and relatively safe. That's a common combination we're looking for these folks who are buying their very first ever house plant.
Yeah. Now, on your list, you talk about that holiday cactus is safe. Is holiday cactus the Schlumbergia?
Yeah, usually called zygocactus, the ones that bloom. I call them holiday cactus because they're Thanksgiving cactus and Christmas cactus, slightly different plants, and those are perfectly safe. And we might as well go in right now and say poinsettias. Poinsettias are not toxic. They're not toxic to people. They're not toxic to pets. They might cause that latex, might cause a little irritation to the skin, but they're not a concern in spite of the widespread belief that poinsettias are dangerous.
Yeah, I think Paul Ecke said that on his deathbed. He said it so many times in his life. He's a big poinsettia grower down in the San Diego area. And you'd meet him and he'd say, "Hi, I'm Paul Ecke. Poinsettias aren't poisonous."
Like a hiccup.
Yes.
He may have been the one also who would eat a leaf on television every so often and say two things. One, it's not poisonous. Two, it tastes terrible.
Yes. Don't eat poinsettias. Yes.
You're not going to eat very many.
Yeah. All right. We have to take a break. We'll have more with Don Shore when we come back to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
If you're tired of paying big fees for cable news and don't want subscriptions to watch it on your phone, you can tune into Newsmax TV right now for free. And every minute you get the latest news with great shows from Mike Huckabee, Greg Kelly, Grant Stinchfield, Michelle Malkin, Diamond and Silk, Alan Dershowitz, and much more. Newsmax TV is the fastest growing cable news channel in America and on all the major cable systems like DirecTV, Dish, Xfinity, Charter, Cox, Optimum, and more. Plus, you can get Newsmax for free on Roku, Zumo, YouTube, Pluto, Apple TV, Chromecast, Amazon Fire, or your smart TV. So don't pay anymore for cable news channels. Save big money and get Newsmax on your home TV. Or just download the free Newsmax app from your smartphone store and start watching us anytime, anywhere. Everyone is talking about Newsmax TV because it's real news for real people.
It may still be summer, but cool season vegetable and flower planting time is approaching. And Big Oak Nursery in Elk Grove has all you need to get off to a great start. They've got the plants and they have the soil amendments, including all the great gardener and bloom products. It's Big Oak Nursery. They're all outdoors, plenty of room for social distancing. Locally owned, locally grown, Big Oak Nursery, open 7 days a week, 10071 Grantline Road in Elk Grove, and online at bigoaknursery.com.
You save more at Elk Grove, because Elk Grove sells Fords.
Get Growing continues with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Art and Grappler coming up at 11 o'clock. A chance for you to pick up a prize or two. There is a clue available at FarmerFred.com. Clue available at the Get Growing with Farmer Fred Facebook page beneath that picture of Janet Craig, as a matter of fact, I think. Maybe not. I don't know. I can't remember anymore because there's too much smoke. Don Shore is with us from Redwood Barn Nursery in Davis. We're talking a wide variety of things, and we're also answering your questions at 916-576-1578, 866-331-8255. Let's go up to Auburn and talk with Maria. Maria, thanks for hanging in there. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. What's up?
We have many dwarf wheelers in our yard that we've had for years. They're not brand new, always doing really good. And recently we've been finding dead branches. We cut them off when you're but everything else looks perfect. There's a branch here and there, so we cut them off. But when you look inside, the branch looks like it's peeling. At first I thought maybe there was a rat or a mouse eating it, but it doesn't look like they're eating it. It just looks like it's peeling.
I don't even know what a dwarf wheeler is.
Wheeler's Dwarf Mock Orange. It's a
Okay. All right. I knew it sounded vaguely familiar. It's the other way around. It's a pit.
Customers have had this problem that have dealt with what you're describing have generally found that it's caused by voles where we are. The meadow mouse, which lives in the nearby fields or in grassy areas, comes in, likes all that nice, dense habitat of the very tight growth habit of the Wheeler's Dwarf, and gets in there, this is one possibility, and gnaws enough of the bark away to girdle the stem above that point. And we see this in late summer in our area on citrus trees occasionally, and on Wheeler's Dwarf and other types of pittosporum. Happened to one of my xylosma. It isn't just meadow mice that do it. We had a problem with what we call tree rats or roof rats doing it as well. We don't know what they're after, but they get up there and they gnaw away enough of the bark to kill that branch, and the rest of the plant basically looks healthy. So that's one possibility, and it's very challenging to deal with because pretty much what I'll tell you is, remove habitat. Well, the Wheeler's Dwarf itself is the habitat. They like that dense cover that it's creating. So mostly people just get in, prune out the affected portion, that resprouts. That's the good news. Wheeler's Dwarf, like all pittosporum, can resprout very quickly, and the problem sort of goes away until next year, late in the summer, and sometimes it happens again. So if you've got grassy areas nearby, those should be mowed and so on. It's not an easy thing to deal with. There is an occasional disease problem on pittosporum in general. Pittosporum tenuifolium and some of the other species get this so routinely that I don't really recommend them. It occasionally happens to the Wheeler's Dwarf. It's a fungus that attacks when you're spraying with sprinklers that are causing moisture to be trapped there, and the branch will get infected on one point and simply die. And you prune that out once again. That's the simple answer. If you water with drip, it's usually less of a problem. It's more associated with sprinkler irrigation. But in both cases, the only answer is to get in there carefully, prune it out, rake out any debris, kind of open it up for better air movement for the disease, to reduce habitat for the rodents that might be harboring in there, and the problem seems to magically go away on its own.
Wow, you do that so well. You ought to be own a nursery.
Well, no product for this. No spray, no nothing.
Well, thank you, Eric. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. Yes. I would have just said, well, just deal with it.
Well, that's a shorter way of saying what I said.
Yeah, I know. Maria, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. I even owned a Wheeler's Dwarf pit. It's like... That's how.
I don't know what they're after. I have a customer who has this problem routinely on their lemon tree. It's near a fence line, and so every year, a branch or two, just they look out. They're flagging, is the term we use. They're dead. They go out. They find the bark has been gnawed away, and I say, well, you know, you can try repellents. You can try trapping. If you've got an answer for roof rats, then we can become millionaires together.
Yeah.
There's no easy solution on that one, except prune it away and get it away from the fence line a little bit. And it seems to be very seasonal, so I'm not exactly sure what the deal is. We need to get more into rodent biology here, but it's good news is it tends to be transient.
Yeah, you know, here in Folsom, there's this interesting phenomenon going on of copper pipes developing pinhole leaks, and it's happened to hundreds of homes scattered throughout the community, and they're trying to figure out why it's happening. And a lot of people are replacing these problem copper pipes with PEX pipes, P-E-X, which is a more flexible sort of plastic pipe instead of the copper pipes. Turns out rats love to chew the PEX pipes.
Trade one problem for another.
Yeah. So just a word of warning about that. All right. Email question from Leslie, who says, does using landscape fabric with mulch on top under a fruit tree prevent the benefits of mulch improving the soil? Yes. Your thoughts, Don?
Landscape fabric, there's a whole bunch of different brands out there, and most of them are pretty useless, but there are some heavy-duty ones that are woven materials. Now, if we're using landscape fabric, we prefer to use those because they allow water and air to go in and out, but they block the breakdown of the mulch, which would build the soil. So if you're trying to build the soil with mulch, just add a bunch of mulch and keep adding. And 4 or 5, 6 inches is fine. Arborist wood chips, whatever you buy from your local rock yard, from your garden center, just keep adding it, and it breaks down. That's what it's supposed to do. Well, if the fabric is there, obviously it can't get into the soil. So,
yeah, exactly. And you will regret down the line having put down landscape fabric when you decide to redo that area. Landscape fabric is fine on a permanent planting location where you never plan to go back in to replace any plants, because once you start trying to replace plants, you're going to be bringing up that landscape fabric piece by piece.
I use it for paths. I use it for walkways and things like that. It's great for that. But again, never buy the cheap stuff. I don't know why it's even on the shelves in hardware stores. Buy the heavy-duty stuff if you're using it, and install it with lots of anchor pins, and it should last a long time. But it does reduce air movement. It does reduce water penetration. So it has some drawbacks.
Yeah, despite the fact it's supposedly permeable. And by the way, there are still some one-way fabrics on the market, which means if you install it upside down, it repels both air and water. So when you put down that kind of landscape fabric to begin with, pour some water on it. Make sure it does go through.
Here's a rule of thumb. If it's less than a dollar a running foot, it isn't worth it.
Okay, there you go. All right. Alan writes in, he says, should I put some chicken manure on my raised beds before I start planting my fall garden? I think it depends on the age of the chicken manure.
Yeah, chicken manure is a concern with contamination of leafy greens. And so I have no problem at all with its use in the summer vegetable garden where you're doing tomatoes and things like that. But putting it just on the surface and then planting lettuce, spinach, things like that, where it might splash up onto the leaves, that is asking for trouble. Incorporating it is fine, but just putting it on the surface is not a safe practice.
Yeah, and the good news is there are some pelletized, if that's a word, chicken manure products which might mitigate that issue.
They've been dehydrated in pretty high temperatures, so they're considered safe. They're hard to find, though. So,
yeah, and they're not cheap either. But I think, working it in the soil makes a heck of a lot more sense in that regard. All right, let's talk about some happy stuff. You know, sitting on my kitchen counter waiting for me to go to work in the garden this afternoon, I am soaking some Oregon sugar pod peas and am looking forward to planting them using a tomato cage from a recently pulled out tomato plant.
Yeah, this is the time to change over for some of those. Peas are great to plant in September. You'll get a good start on them. You might even be harvesting for the holidays. You can keep planting further on into the season, and those will be producing more in late, more in the wintertime, February, March. But if you can get them in quickly and keep them watered, that's the key thing, water carefully and get them up and growing, you might be harvesting for Christmas.
And by soaking the seeds, by softening that seed coat, they'll germinate a bit quicker, too.
Now, the rule of thumb I learned from Dr. Robert Norris, the vegetable crops expert extraordinaire over here in Yolo County, plant the peas, water once, don't water again until they sprout.
I thought that was
really
beans.
And same with beans, but especially peas and beans, if you water them too much, they need moisture as they're germinating, but they're prone to rot. So once I started adopting that technique, you plant them, you water really thoroughly, might even mulch the area a little bit, and then you don't water again. And it's really hard to not water. Don't water again until they're up and out of the ground. They should do fine.
Another cool season annual that does well here and also requires soaking of seeds would be nasturtiums.
Yeah, and we talk a lot about vegetables at this time of year. There's lots of flowers you can plant, and people are beginning to come in thinking in those terms. And nasturtiums, by the way, are great planting project. For those of you a little housebound with kids at the moment, they're big. Their seeds are easy to manipulate. They sprout quickly. The leaves are cool. You can sprout them indoors. They'll grow in a windowsill for a while. So they're really easy to grow. And they're easy to grow in containers, and they'll go all the way into freezing weather. And if they're a little sheltered, they'll even get through the freezing weather. So they're actually really one of the best seeds for planting projects and just getting things going if you're limited for space outdoors. But right now we can also plant a lot of cool season flowers, and the weather is great for it. This week we're talking about the familiar things like pansies and violas, snapdragons, which you can get going now to get lots of winter bloom and all the way into the spring, calendula, which I kind of had gotten away from because they look sort of weedy. Well, there's a lot of new ones and a lot of very cool calendulas out there. They're really easy to grow. So another one for a quick, simple planting project if you've got a sunny winter location. This is the best time to plant stock right now. Mm-hmm. To get a good established plant for winter bloom. If you plant them too late, they just get one spike. But if you plant them now, they'll make a nice, robust crown and give you a bunch of spikes of flowers and a lot of other things. And it's also a good time to start thinking about scattering wildflower seeds, California poppies, things like that.
We'll take a short break. When we come back, let's delve into more details about annuals and perennials and other things that we can be planting now. Don Chore is here, Redwood Barn Nursery. We'll take a short break. More with Don coming up on Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
You're listening to Get Growing with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
We may be talking about outdoor gardening, but the air is such that you may want to just stay indoors. Unhealthy air to the point of hazardous air throughout the region. I'm looking at purpleair.com, and throughout the Sacramento area, numbers in the 200s, some in the 300s. Yeah. Over in the Bay Area, it's basically hazardous air from 150 to 200. We like to see air from 0 to 100. Anytime it gets over 150 or so, if you're in a sensitive group, and that would be, of course, anybody who cries at Barry Manilow tunes, you want to stay indoors. All right. So Don,
yeah, we were talking, up popped air alert from Lincoln 239 AQI, very unhealthy. And I thought, now let's talk about what to go out and do in your garden this afternoon.
Yes,
maybe plan this afternoon.
I mean, no, especially the closer you get to the fires, some of these numbers are just outrageous. Like up in the Oroville area, where that one big fire, I think they're calling it now the North Complex fire, is burning. It's like numbers in the 500s. So that's where you can probably see the flames. But
once this clears out, late September and the month of October are really active garden times, because really the whole everything, vegetables, flowers, it's a great time for perennials. Flower bulbs are coming into garden centers. It's a wonderful time to plant shrubs and trees. So, you know, we're on the cusp of a very busy time. And looking at the weather, the numbers in terms of high temperatures over the next week or so, and the fact of where we are on the calendar, it's a really good time to plan ahead for that kind of thing. You were mentioning peas. We can plant beets and carrots and kale. I should mention kale because it's hugely popular. Lettuce, onions will be planted either from seedlings now or from transplants, bare root plants in early November. So it's a very busy time. We want you all to be healthy. So do some thinking now and figure out what you want blooming and growing in your vegetable garden, and maybe wait a couple days.
Yeah, exactly. Plan your cool season garden. Don't necessarily plant it yet, but it doesn't take long to plant snow peas.
Yeah, there's a lot of nurseries selling six packs, those little pony packs of vegetables. I've taken some when they first came in. We got our first shipment in. It was very hot. So I just shifted them right up into 4-inch pots, and they responded very, very well to that, just like we do with peppers and tomatoes back at the start of the summer season. And I'm going to plant those cabbages out shortly. I've let them grow on up a little bit further, and they're getting off to a good head start. So there's some things you can do if you get those little plants. Keep them moving. Don't keep them root-bound in the little pots you bought them in.
Why, that's a tip you gave on the latest Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast, where you talk about taking your six packs, and if you can't plant them immediately, transplant them with some pretty good soil into 4-inch pots, and they're going to be stronger as a result.
They'll be bigger plants. They'll have a better root system. Also, this is a time of year that people don't think about this a lot, but it's a great time to get going on perennials to flower next year. You can save a lot of money by doing them from seed or little packs or single plants you buy. We're talking about foxgloves and columbine and coral bells. We have six packs of columbine right now. It's a great time to plant them now for bloom next spring. You get them for, you know, a few bucks, you can get six plants, or you're welcome to come in the spring and buy them for $12 a piece in gallon cans. Either way is fine with me. But if you're a frugal gardener, this is the time to look for those kinds of deals, because you can get plant ahead now for what's going to bloom next spring and summer.
There is an Erigeron I'm looking for, the Santa Barbara daisy. Is that commonly carried in nurseries this time of year?
Yeah, this is a great time to look for it in 4-inch pots and quart pots, and you'll put them in, they'll do a little bit of growth, they'll continue to bloom, they bloom all the time, and that plant will be rooted in and strong and ready to go when things warm up in the late winter, and it'll just take off at that point. So a lot of those things start coming in. You know, we in the nursery business, we hold off on the smaller pots when it's really hot, but as soon as it cools off, we love to bring in those 4-inch and quart pots and jumbo packs for people who are thinking ahead to next year. It's just that a lot of the market is out there, people just buying stuff in bloom. But you can really save money and have a very lush garden for a lot less cost if you do a little planning ahead, 3, 6, 9 months ahead of time.
Now, I want you to speak as a gardener, not as a nursery owner, but okay. My wife and I are having this discussion about Santa Barbara daisy as far as, yes, can you take an existing stand of Santa Barbara daisy and basically dig out some of it and transplant it, and it will take. She insists that can be done. I would like to go and buy a six-pack or so. Your thoughts.
And you want me to answer that as a gardener? It can be done, but the plant will collapse, I guarantee it. So you'll have to trim it back after it goes through that collapse process, the transplant shock, if you will, and then nurture it as it pushes back out. Whereas your approach will look more attractive from the start.
And it will keep my local independent nursery owner in gravy. Yes.
Well, you told me not to answer as a nursery owner.
Yes.
I do what I'm told.
But it is a very nice ground cover, and it, like you say, it just blooms 12 months a year here.
Yeah. Yeah. Also strongly attracts beneficials. You almost always find syrphid flies all over that plant, and they, of course, their larvae are voracious aphid eaters. Anything in the daisy group, great to have in your garden, brings in beneficials.
Really, and it's the common name for it is fleabane. It's an Erigeron.
Get rid of that. There are these common names in our industry that I think we need to abolish, and that's one of them. You don't want the name flea or tick or anything like that in a common name. So we've got I think Santa Barbara daisy is a nicer name. Erigeron, yeah. Carvinskianus.
Yes, indeed. What about pruning perennials now? Is this the time to do it?
It's a good time to trim them back if they're looking kind of spent and done blooming, especially the herbaceous ones, you know, that might be like the soft ones that might be done with their major bloom for the season. And typically October is when we do a lot of that. So you'd go out your Rudbeckias and the Echinaceas when they're finished, you go ahead and cut them back, cut off the spent blossoms and make it look better. I do remember when my wife was pregnant, 8 months pregnant, she took a mower to the perennial border because it was easier. And I came home and saw that she had done that, cleaned it up real nicely. I've never done that since, but it did the job. Mowed about 3 inches high. So getting them cut back and trimmed, not the woody plants, not the shrubby things, you know, those you do much more lightly. We're talking about what are technically called herbaceous perennials.
Did it come back?
Oh, beautifully. And the baby was born, right. Everything went well.
Okay. All right. But the garden was okay. That's the important part. Okay.
That's right.
Right. That's a good thing. Well, we got to wrap stuff up here. So Redwood Barn Nursery, it's still in Davis. I think it's still on 5th Street. I think I said G Street last time. It's 5th Street,
yeah,
isn't
close.
It?
1607 5th Street between L and Poline. It's a red barn. You can't miss it as you head down 5th Street. We'll open at noon.
From noon to 5 today.
Yep. Always great to be here. Thanks, Fred.
Don Shore, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Coming up, Garden Grappler time, a chance for you to pick up a prize or two from the Farmer Fred Prize Closet. Don't forget this show also available as a podcast, and you can pick it up soon after its completion at noon. You can find it wherever podcasts are freely given away, and that would include the iHeartRadio app. And also, while I'm plugging shows, don't forget the KSTE Farm Hour coming up from noon until 1 o'clock. We have an interesting report. If you own horses, you need to hear a little chat I had with a state veterinarian about the spread of West Nile virus among horses. It's starting to pick up again as the fall mosquito season starts beginning. It's important for horse owners to keep an eye on their horses so that they don't get it, and they keep up on their vaccinations. And we talk about that as far as the regimen for doing that. So we'll talk about that. Also, the effect of smoke on livestock. We're going to talk about that as well. So that's coming up on the KSTE Farm Hour. Garden Grappler coming up.
Get Growing continues with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
All right, it's Garden Grappler time. A chance for you to pick up a prize or two from the Farmer Fred Prize Closet. I think we gave away a few of the answers to this one while talking with Don Shore. But maybe you can come up with your own as well, or repeat what you heard earlier. Today's Garden Grappler question, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, is very simply put: name a plant that blooms during the fall with a yellow flower. Name a plant that blooms during the fall with a yellow flower. Now, I didn't say must bloom in fall, just that it might be a summer bloomer, it might be a winter bloomer, but it has an overlapping period where it also blooms in fall. So name a plant that blooms during the fall that has a yellow flower. I like yellow. The numbers to call in for the Garden Grappler: 916-576-1578. 916-576-1578. Or 866-331-8255. 866-331-8255. Name a plant that blooms during the fall that has a yellow flower. All five callers get a prize, special bonus prize for caller five, because as you know, in the Garden Grappler, you cannot repeat an earlier answer. So while Cameron back there in the studio is frantically writing down names and numbers and possible answers, I recently over on the Garden Basics podcast, we did a segment about edible ornamentals, plants you may not even think of as being edible. Did you know roses are edible? You might think of the hips for tea, but there's so much more. And we had a conversation with Debbie Arrington, a former Sacramento Bee garden writer, now composes, along with Kathy Morrison, the excellent Sacramento Digs gardening blog. And Debbie could talk at length that she's one of the few people I ever met that has done a rose taste test. So while you're thinking of Garden Grappler answers, let's listen to what Debbie had to say. I contacted a few of my rosarian friends to see if, what does a rose petal taste like? And we're talking about petals here. And Debbie Arrington replied and said, well, of course I did. And here's Debbie Arrington now. And Debbie, you actually have conducted a taste test of various rose petals.
Yes, I did. And, I should note that besides other things, I'm president of the Sacramento Rose Society. And so I am surrounded by a lot of rose experts, and we are always looking for new things to do with roses. But my rose taste test came many years ago, back when I was a food editor, and I wrote a story about edible flowers. And so then we did a little taste test of, well, what do flowers taste like and which ones are good and which ones are not. And roses are probably one of the most easiest edible flowers that are around you. Now, the thing about roses is you want to make sure they're not sprayed.
Right.
Because, you know, you don't want to eat anything that you've been using insecticides or pesticides on or anything like that. But when you think about it, roses they're from the same family as a lot of fruits. That's why, you know, you have rose hips on rose bushes that, you know, after the roses are developed and mature, you know, that has rose hip jelly and rose hip tea and all sorts of different things with that. But the flowers also are very tasty. And what we found was that the flowers that had the best fragrance, the strongest scent, tended to have the most taste in the petals also.
Is that a good thing, though? Flavor?
It was a pleasing flavor. It was like a slightly sweet cloves. Hmm. Roses have a lot of vitamin C in them. So they have kind of that, oh, that citrusy note that you get from any of your citrus family, where you have that kind of zesty taste on the back of your tongue. You think to yourself, like, oh, this is vitamin C. You know, this, you know, it's that it's slightly acidic. But the main flavor that you're getting out of most roses is sort of like cloves. It's a little spiciness that you sense on the back of your tongue. What we found also was that roses, the old style roses, like old garden roses, which have a ton of fragrance, they have a lot of flavor also. And I also found that the Austin roses, which are big shrub roses and also very, very fragrant, they not only have that slightly sweet, spicy cloveness to them, but if down in the little petals that are towards the center of the flower, they pick up a little bit of the nectar too. And so they're actually sweet, sweet, mm-hmm. like honey sweet. So it was interesting. The ones that we found that had the most flavor tended to be the red colored roses. And the red on them, I think part of that is that those roses tend to have a lot of fragrance also, like your Mr. Lincoln's, you know, and other, you know, red roses that have that definite, oh, fragrance to them. But the ones that were just like light colored white rose, they tended not to have much taste to them at all. They kind of were like crunchy lettuce.
So how are they best served?
In salad, fresh. They're better when they're younger. You know, so if the rose has been, if it's already bloomed and on its last legs and beginning to brown and stuff like that, it's over the top and it tastes sort of like wilted lettuce. But if the rose is fresh, it has that crispness and it has that kind of slightly spicy taste. It's sort of like a mild arugula. Mm. It's sort of like in that thing where there's like a little spice and bitterness, but not too bitter. It's more, it's kind of like a sharpness to it. Than bitter. And so salad. It's definitely a salad ingredient. And they also can be used in tea. You know, you can just go ahead and use the petals and you know, put them in some water and let them steep.
Is there any advantage to a single-petaled rose versus a multi-layered rose flower?
A lot of the single-petaled roses have a lot of fragrance. And so they do have pretty good flavor also. You know, you could also use them in to flavor, sorbet or sugars and candy and things like that too.
So on I'll call it a complicated. You being a rosarian would have the name for it, a rose flower that has rows and rows of petals. Uh-huh. Are any of those better than others? The younger ones versus the older ones, or the smaller ones? Are they tastier than the larger ones?
Oh, you mean the size of the roses?
Of the petals.
Size of the petals. Well, the small petals that are towards the center of the flower, those are the ones that are going to pick up a little bit of the nectar from it. So those tend to have the best taste to them. And the larger petals on the outside, they've been around longer. So they're like the outer, think of it as like a head of lettuce. And the outer leaves of the lettuce, they tend to go limp. You know, and they tend to have the less taste, while the inner leaves of the lettuce there in the heart, they seem to have the best crispness and the best taste.
Is there a bitter part to that rose petal, like the point where you yank it away from the flower, that little brace towards the back of the petal? Is that more bitter than the rest of the petal?
No. The bitterness that I found with some of them was they were just older. They, you know, had bloomed for a while and had gotten a little tired.
Since you are a master rosarian, Debbie Arrington, and a mm-hmm. garden writer and a big time vegetable gardener, defend the use of a rose bush in a food garden.
Oh, because, well, a rose bush, it's like a big sign to bees and other beneficial insects that come and get it. There's lots of stuff here.
So it attracts beneficials and pollinators.
It attracts beneficials and pollinators, yeah.
And it's pretty.
And it's free, yeah.
Yeah.
And also the rose is a food plant, you know, so why not? You know, the thing about roses is that you got to think that roses are the favorite thing for deers to eat. Roses are deer candy. You know, they will, you know, and wild roses, you know, out in the forest and stuff, they just go crazy over them. there's a reason why. It's because they taste good, you know, and they like them compared to other things. So that's one of the reasons why they gravitate towards it.
There you go. Roses for your garden, even if it's a food garden, you're adding another source of food to your backyard cornucopia.
Yes, and if you are seriously looking at the rose plant as a food plant, definitely let your hips develop because the hips are delicious. Roses are from the same family as plums and peaches and things like that. So the hips kind of taste like a tangy apricot flavor. They have that sort of brightness to them. And the rose hips have the most flavor of any part of the plant. And so they make an excellent tea. They make an excellent jelly. And they're just pretty, too.
So I guess the way to develop rose hips is to keep your shears away from the rose bush.
Yes, exactly. Well, you don't really want them to develop hips yet, you know, because they stay blooming as long as you keep trimming off your spent blooms. But in the fall, you know, starting in October, go ahead and let those spent blooms stay on the plant and mature, and then you'll get your rose hips, and they'll turn a nice orange and red color, and that's when you harvest them.
October for California, for the warmer parts of California. For other parts of the country, though, when should you stop pruning back your roses to let the hips develop?
About the same time, about October.
Okay.
Yeah, because the hips will be ready in about 4 weeks, so in November, and that'd be fine.
There you go. Roses. It's part of your daily diet now. Master Rosarian, garden writer. She is the author of the Sacramento Digs Gardening blog, an excellent garden resource for us here locally. If you live someplace else, check it out. There's a lot of good information in there. SacDigsGardening.blogspot.com. Debbie Arrington, thanks for eating roses for us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We have one open line left for the Garden Grappler. The question today is, name a plant that blooms during the fall that has a yellow flower. The numbers to call in, 916-576-1578 or 866-331-8255. I bet we'll get some answers on that one. All right, we'll find out. We got prizes, bonus prize for caller five, of course.
Listening to Get Growing with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
All right. We're in the Garden Grappler. People are going to name plants that have blooms during the fall that have a yellow flower. You may have one, too. We have one open line. 916-576-1578 or 866-331-8255. Batting leadoff, it's John in Fallbrook, but I think John has a question before he has an answer. Hi, John.
Hi. Hey, Fred, how are you today?
Smoky, thank you.
Yeah, that's terrible. My question, you were talking Santa Barbara daisies earlier with Dawn, and I wondered if I could transplant those from clippings.
Yes, you can, but in the spring.
Do I got to put them in pots first, or can I put
this wonderful reference book I have from the American Horticultural Society called Plant Propagation recommends that you treat them the same way as asters, and that is division in spring, or plant from seeds in spring, or do cuttings in spring. And it says to root the cuttings in pots. In a closed case or on a mist bench, pot and grow on in a cold frame. I don't think you have to worry about that in Fallbrook.
Jeez. Yeah, that was a little over the top. You almost discouraged me there.
No. No. You live in the permanent zone of nice weather. So it's like, just go ahead, stick it in a pot. And I would use seed starting soil. I wouldn't use your garden soil to get it started to help develop roots, because you want good drainage. The one problem with encouraging roots from cuttings is if the soil is too wet, there may not be enough oxygen to help the development of roots. So use a seed starting mix. But again, you want to do it when it's actively growing. Now, one could say, well, in Fallbrook, down in San Diego County, it's always actively growing. So I'd say, heck? Go ahead, give it a shot. What the heck?
Yeah, it doesn't hurt anything. And then I would keep it moist, but make sure it drains. Huh? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. It's, as far as the cutting goes, and I wouldn't worry. It's not like a seed. You're not trying to get it to germinate. All you're trying to do is develop roots, and for that, what you need is soil that has oxygen as well as a lack of pathogens, and that's the beauty of a seed starting mix, is it doesn't have the pathogens that would be found in your garden soil.
And what? How big of a root structure do you think I need before I put them in the ground?
Oh, you'll see it actively growing. When you see it growing, go ahead. I mean, you could always gently, after you've watered it, pop it out of the container and take a look at the roots. If you start seeing the roots on the side, it's time to transplant.
Oh, great.
That would work.
Fred.
Now, John, do you want to name a plant with a yellow flower?
The only thing I can think of off the top of my head would be a rose bush, but I don't know if that's what you're looking for.
Well, can you name a variety of rose with a yellow flower?
No, I just got a bush rose, that a couple of them. I got a long stem yellow, and I got a bush rose that's yellow, but no, I can't tell you the name.
Okay, be that way, but you got some good advice.
That's all I was really hoping for. Thank you very much, Fred. Have a great day.
You too, John. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. All right. Well, that means we're backed up with five callers who just might get themselves a nice prize. All right. So let's go to who would have been caller two, but isn't in reality caller number one. And that would be Kathy in Sacramento. So, Kathy, go ahead. Give us a plant with a yellow flower in the fall.
Would a Shasta daisy count?
Because it has a nice little yellow center, right? Yeah. Why not? All right, good answer, Shasta daisy, and I have for you the 10 most wanted bugs in your garden and the note card with a stamped envelope for you to forward to somebody who's living alone or in isolation because they want to be or they have to be.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate it. All right. Caller number two in today's Garden Grappler, it's Ron in Lincoln. So, Ron, go ahead and give us what you think might be a plant with a yellow flower in the fall.
Yes, sir, Farmer Fred. This is Ron. Okay, so I've got an answer, but also I've got a question at the end for you, okay?
Okay.
All right. Okay, so the only flower that I can think of right now would be the perennial sunflower.
Sure, yeah. Actually, any sunflower would do just because, let's face it, fall starts in 8 days. So if you have a sunflower in bloom today, probably in 8 days it'll still be in bloom. And, yeah, sunflowers are yellow. Good answer, Ron.
Okay. So the question I have for you is I bought some lemon trees. They're about 3.5 gallon containers, a couple lemon trees and orange tree. And I haven't planted them yet, so question I was going to ask you was I added some NutriRich to the containers when I took it home last week, and then might have made a mistake because after listening to your guests with Red Barn Nursery there, I think I made a mistake by putting this fertilizer too soon, and also I want to find out, Fred, when would be a good time to transplant this into the ground? I live in in the desert, Lincoln Desert, you know, purgatory, you know.
And, the Lincoln Desert. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Fall is great for planting. I, if you have them, I would plant them sometime during September or October. And as far as I don't think you have to worry about the NutriRich, because NutriRich is a pelletized form of chicken manure. So it's been well aged. It's been processed. You're not going to burn the plant or cause any problems. But I'm glad to see that you are going to be transplanting them soon, just because by fertilizing them, you're encouraging more root growth in that plant that's still in a 3.5 gallon container. And you don't want to stress the roots too much. So, yeah, go ahead and get those plants in the ground.
Okay, so if I don't transplant it now and I wait till next fall, you think I'm risking the chance of maybe causing some suffocation in the pot with the roots on that?
Well, in a 3.5 gallon container is fairly small. The good news is the fact that with fall coming, the plant is going to put on less growth and prepare for a spring spurt of growth. Can you plant it at least next spring?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, why can't you plant it now?
Well, I can, but I'm asking you, is it too soon to plant it? Or should I just wait a little longer and then the next fall or spring and then plant it? Or should I just go ahead and plant it in the fall?
Go ahead and, like I say, plant it sometime in September or October. You should be fine.
Okay, will do.
All right, Ron.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Caller number three is Marilyn in Loomis. Marilyn, go ahead and give us a plant with a yellow flower in the fall.
Okay, and I have a question for you also. Calendula.
Okay, yes, I know. Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, I thought you were coming in with the question first. Calendula is a good answer. I like that. One of my favorite yellow fall flowers is a calendula. Good answer.
It's sort of blooming all summer, actually, around here. Placer County, but
well, you know, it's odd, but yes, it does happen. In fact, I got to confess, I have a calendula. It was a volunteer out in my yard that's been blooming now for a couple of months as well, too. So go figure.
Okay, then I originally had heard plant your fava beans in August or late August, and so I did, and. It was so hot, so I think I must have overwatered because it's now been 3 weeks, and I'm probably getting less than 10% have sprouted. And so I'm going to plant again, but I think I heard you water them once deeply and put a compost, you know, around them, and you don't touch them again. They'll rot. So I think I might have been... might be dealing with rot as well.
And as
I
heat.
Know, in fact, I've got somebody underground eating them because I actually tried to dig up and see what's going on, and the holes are there in the ground. So gophers, moles.
Oh, you got all sorts of problems.
Exactly. And so my real question is, what's your opinion as to the best time to plant fava beans? Eating and for cover crop.
September.
Oh, then I was too early. Okay.
Yeah, because of the heat and because if they do sprout, you know, they may not be able to take that kind of heat.
Right.
And collapse. But the gophers, I would put some sort of a wire cage in the ground, with maybe quarter inch or half inch openings, some sort of hardware cloth, perhaps, and maybe bend it into a U shape and place that in a trench and then place the seeds in the trench and the soil. Put in the bent hardware cloth and then put in some soil, then put in the seeds. And maybe that'll stop them from at least killing off that fava bean when it sprouts roots, because the plant will have a chance to develop some roots and maybe can survive the gopher eating the roots once the roots have become established and are growing outside of that hardware cloth.
Right. And I did catch a mole, and then I read where they actually eat bugs that are both detrimental, so you want them in a way, but they can't distinguish between the good or the bad, so they're eating the good ones too.
Yeah, just like a praying mantis. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Thank you. I will give that a go.
All right, Marilyn, I'll be sending you from our friends at Our Water, Our World, their wonderful handout of the 10 most wanted bugs in your garden and a note card with a stamped envelope to forward on to a person who's isolated in these trying times.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Marilyn. Bye-bye. Caller number four in today's Garden Grappler in Citrus Heights, it's Julie. Julie, go ahead. Give us a plant with a yellow flower in the fall, would you please?
I have swamp sunflowers that aren't blooming yet, but getting ready to, and they just bloom in the fall.
So, yeah, and I think it was Ron and Lincoln who mentioned basically the Mexican sunflower, or just the standard sunflower, but the swamp sunflower. Now, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, they're tiny little blossoms. They're not big, but, they don't bloom until a little bit later.
That would be excellent. Good answer, Julie. So I'll be sending you all that stuff. I told Marilyn, Ron, and Kathy I'd send them.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. Bye-bye. And that takes us to caller number five in today's Garden Grappler. It's Denise in Lincoln. And Denise, if you can name a yellow blooming fall plant I have for you, since you live in Lincoln, in the next couple of days, I'm going to be getting the Placer County Master Gardener Garden Guide and Calendar.
Oh, yay. Yay,
and
yay, yay.
I would be glad to send you one of those once they get into my hot little hands, if you can name a plant with a yellow flower in the fall.
Oh, goody. I'm hoping for chrysanthemum.
I think a chrysanthemum, especially those with the pretty little yellow center, would be a good answer. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's all great. Right. Good answer, Denise. Did you have a backup great answer just in case?
I was thinking calendula, too. But yeah, that was already given.
That's the problem. But no, chrysanthemum is fine. And I'll be sent when it gets to me, I'll get it one to you, the Placer County 2021 Master Gardener Garden Guide and Calendar.
Okay. I just want to tell you, I used to call you when I lived in Paradise.
Oh, and wow.
So we are relocated in Lincoln. And we're happy. We're loving it here. We're having a new home built.
Good.
And we have kids here, so we're good.
Yeah, well, my thoughts go out to you and to everybody, who live or attempting to resettle up in Paradise and to have another fire knocking at their door.
Yep.
That I believe, I think they were able to keep it away from Paradise at least.
Yeah, well, my mother-in-law was evacuated already this last week, but she's back home.
So. Oh, she's back home? Good. All right, so that means the threat has abated for now.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
Good. All right, okay. Denise, thanks for calling.
All righty. Thank you, and I look forward to my calendar.
Yes, you will. It might take
a while,
but you'll get one.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
When we come back, we are going to find out the truth about, do walnuts and walnut trees impede the growth of nearby plants? We'll find out when we come back to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
Continues with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Let's delve into the garden email bag. Micah from Chico writes in and asks, are there any roses that will thrive near black walnut trees? Or do you have any suggestions for perennials that can be planted near black walnut trees? Well, actually, this question came up when I had some rosarians on the show recently, and we didn't have time to answer it on the air, but we were mulling it over during a commercial break. And I think all of us decided that when it comes to planting near black walnut trees, well, good luck. But you know, maybe there's more to the story than that. Doing a deep dive into research, we discovered that at Penn State Extension, they wrote extensively on the topic in a publication called Landscaping and Gardening Around Walnuts and Other Juglone-Producing Plants. Juglone being the secretion of the roots, leaves, hulls, and stems of walnut trees that might inhibit growth of many other different plants in the area. Apparently, according to one research, juglone inhibits plant respiration, depriving sensitive plants of needed energy and cell division, as well as water and nutrient uptake. And sensitive plants, it says, located beneath the canopy of the walnut tree are most susceptible to contact with juglone through direct root contact or accumulation of the toxin from leaves and nut hulls, especially in poor aerated wet soils with limited microbial activity and organic matter. And their suggestions included what we've been saying for years about locating gardens well away from black walnut trees, prevent leaves, hulls, stems from decomposing near planting areas in beds or containers. And then it said, avoid mulch containing walnut bark, wood, hulls, and leaves. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Now, I know people who mulch with all sorts of allegedly toxic trees without much of an issue. And then adding to the mystery, this Penn State Extension publication listed all sorts of plants that could be planted near a black walnut tree, like a forsythia or a daphne, azaleas, hibiscus, hydrangeas, and on and on and on. Well, that, of course, took me over to the Farmer Fred section of my brain, where I realized that in all the walnut orchards around the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin Valley, there is always extensive weed abatement programs going on in walnut orchards. The weeds that are very commonly found in walnut orchards in our area include puncture vine, crabgrass, horse reed, Johnson grass, nut sedge. So there is ongoing weed control in walnut orchards, and these are fully grown walnut trees, and yet weeds are growing. Well, that takes me to Washington State University, where I knew in the back of my brain, I remembered that Linda Chalker Scott once wrote a paper called "Do Black Walnut Trees Have Allelopathic Effects on Other Plants?" And sure enough, what her research found lends credence to Farmer Fred rule number 5, everything you know is wrong. Because as she found out and in her research, all the research about black walnut trees and their alleged allelopathic nature is based on very thin evidence and in some cases non-existing evidence. And she comes to very different conclusions. And that's why we're talking with Linda Chalker Scott right now. She's an associate professor and extension horticulturist at Washington State University, author of several books, including The Informed Gardener, The Informed Gardener Blooms Again, How Plants Work, and Gardening with Native Plants of the Pacific Northwest. And Linda, once again, you're busting myths and saying that if you have a black walnut tree, well, basically go ahead and garden.
It's one of those myths that has been around for decades, and I used to believe it. So when you say, you know, rule number 5 or 1 or whatever it is, everything you know is wrong, absolutely. So this one is something I used to also advise against because of, you know, these publications like you're talking about that have lists of plants that are sensitive and all the problems with allelopathy. And I'm well aware of how allelopathy works, but then getting into the research and finding out exactly what we know and what we don't know, that was an eye-opener.
What did you find out?
Like a lot of other things, you can have allelopathic results when you're doing things in the lab. So in other words, when you're doing things in petri dishes or perhaps with pots of sterile media, and you can absolutely see allelopathic effects from jugwort and a lot of other types of chemicals that certain plants make. But then when you try to do it outside and repeat that work, which is what you have to do if you want this to be practical information, it doesn't work. So it's what I lump into a category of what I call over-extrapolated science, where things work great in the lab, and then when you try to find evidence in the field, it just doesn't exist.
Well, you went to try to find evidence of a written nature, and in some cases, the literature didn't exist.
Exactly. So the literature that does exist that's peer-reviewed and what I consider to be, quality information is really all in the laboratory or sometimes in greenhouse settings, again, with pots of soil or media. When you go out to look for things in the field, the research was the opposite. You know, where they're looking for evidence of jugwort in the soil, it's just not there. So even though the black walnut trees definitely do produce this chemical, it doesn't have an effect when you're looking at a natural landscape. But you get to the interesting part of my exploration in the published literature really was fun this time because it all led back to 2 publications, both of them quite old, from different universities that had these lists of plants that were sensitive and not sensitive. One of those publications was so old that the university had already pulled it and wasn't making it available anymore because it was out of date, 25 years out of date to be exact. But the original paper, which came out of Cornell, doesn't exist. And that was what was so amazing because I had all these references back to this paper and some of them in peer-reviewed journals. And then when I went to Cornell University and talked to the librarians, you know, they looked for days to try to find this 1973 publication. And not only did the first author not exist, but and the publication itself didn't exist. So all of this stuff has been based on either out of date or non-existent information, and it's really quite amazing.
Yeah, and it's very confusing. And I know you're a big proponent of using mulch and lots of mulch. And one of your action points in the paper that you wrote called "Do Black Walnut Trees Have Allelopathic Effects on Other Plants?" You wrote that you can use walnut wood chips for mulch if you have them, and they won't harm plants and work just as well as those from any other woody species.
Yep. That's right. And this is all very interesting to a lot of our friends in Canada who garden because many of them have black walnut trees and many of them have over the years sent me pictures of their lovely gardens underneath the black walnut trees. And so they never could really understand us down here in the States being all bent out of shape about gardening under black walnut trees because they do it all the time. So the evidence is right there in front of our faces, but because we had gotten so attached to this, very fascinating process of allelopathy, that we ignored the fact that we don't see it in the landscape, even though we do see it in the lab. And so it's one of those things as not only over extrapolated, but also I think what we've done mistakenly is we have correlated poor performance of plants and proximity of walnut trees and turned it into a causation. So in other words, black walnut trees are causing poor performance. And frankly, what I think the issue is one of water. Mm. So black walnut trees, especially established ones, you know, are really quite adept at scooping up every little bit of water that's in the soil. And so if you've put in some new plantings or you've got herbaceous stuff, they may not do very well, especially if they're not irrigated or if they're not mulched. And so, but because of this whole allelopathy story, we immediately say, well, it's the black walnuts that are doing it. It is them doing it, but it's their roots doing it by competing for water, not by producing toxic chemicals.
You're right. Many of us will rely on a scientific study and ignore the evidence right in front of our very own eyes. I recall growing up in the middle of a former walnut orchard in a subdivision in the San Fernando Valley, and every home had a walnut tree, and thinking about, for instance, the next door neighbor with a full grown walnut tree in their backyard. And beneath that tree, there was a thriving camellia. There was a lawn. There was all sorts of other shrubs, too. So it's like, well, believe your eyes, folks.
Exactly. And then when you look at these lists, you know, lists of plants you can't grow under walnut trees and the lists you can. And this, you know, this is part of, you know, the scientist in me looking at these and saying, you know, there's no relationship among these plants. I mean, if there was some kind of relationship, you'd expect to see, you know, plants in the same family or something that were affected, but they're all over the place.
Right.
You know, there's no pattern or logic to these lists. And that was what really got me becoming skeptical about the whole issue of allelopathy in the field. And that's why I did the literature search.
One thing you point out in your paper, and I bet this is one of the causes many people would come to believe that you can't grow under walnut trees, is the fact that a walnut tree has big leaves that create a lot of shade, and people may be trying to plant sun-loving plants in the shade of a walnut tree.
Yeah, that never works out very well.
No, it doesn't. And as you pointed, that mulching does improve the soil. And obviously, when you're nourishing the beneficial soil life, you're decreasing the effects of the jug loan.
Exactly. And that's another good point you bring up, because the reason that researchers don't find the chemical in the field is because the microbes and a healthy soil are busy chewing up all of those organic compounds that are there. And jug loan is just another one of those compounds, and it gets degraded relatively rapidly by microbes.
Well, going back to Micah's email question, what roses will grow beneath a black walnut tree? I guess as long as you're on the sunny side of the walnut tree, there should not be any problems.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. If there's enough sun so that they thrive, because roses, as you know, really don't like being in the shade, and they're getting sufficient water and they're mulched well, they should do great.
Now, what about the effect of dropping leaves, stems, walnut shells, and all that? Do you have to clean up those leaves out of the beds?
Nobody ever has, you know, in nature, and things grow just fine in nature. Again, because the walnut leaves are going to be degraded relatively rapidly by microbes in the soil, along with the chemicals there, they just aren't going to have an effect. I will say that it's kind of a problem if you allow to have a very deep layer of what I'm going to call smooth, large leaves, because that can create anaerobic conditions in the soil. And then you do have some issues, but not necessarily from the jug loan, but just from lack of oxygen in the soil. So while I love using leaves in beds over the winter, and I do it myself, I don't like having dense layers of very smooth, you know, kind of sheet-like leaves, because it does interfere with oxygen movement.
There you go. Go ahead and plant. Linda says it's okay. Linda Jocker-Scott, Washington State University. I mentioned the books that you have out. Talk a little bit about your Facebook page.
Oh, well, you know, we've got both a Facebook page and a group. And so the Facebook page, which is The Garden Professors, is kind of a clearinghouse for good science-based information. And so we have, you know, links to interesting articles or other websites, sometimes just fun stuff. So it's just basically every day there's several posts of things that are of interest to gardeners. And then we have the group, which right now has over 23,000 people in it. and it deals with discussing garden and landscape issues from a scientific basis. You know, it's a group and we don't do home remedies. We don't do anecdotes. You know, we use good science to answer questions, and it works really well. I mean, there's always some difficulty when you're bursting someone's bubble about some favorite anecdotal information they have. But, you know, that's how we all learn. And if, as you and I say, you know, what you know is wrong, and we can both admit that. And if we can admit that, then everybody else can, too.
Check out her paper online. Do black walnut trees have allelopathic effects on other plants? I think you will be pleasantly surprised. Linda Chalker-Scott, associate professor and extension horticulturist with Washington State University. Thanks for a few minutes of your time.
You bet, Fred. Thank you.
You're listening to Get Growing on Talk 650 KSTE.
You're listening to Get Growing with Farmer Fred. Talk 650 KSTE. Here again, Fred Hoffman.
Just time enough to tell you, we'll be back next Sunday with another thrill-packed edition of Get Growing. I think we're going to be talking with, among other people, Warren Roberts from the UC Davis Arboretum. Find out what plants are putting on a show in September. Find out which ones actually probably did fairly well or didn't do as well with all the heat and the smoke of the last month or so. So we'll be talking to Warren about that. Also, don't forget, this show is available as a podcast. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, and that includes the iHeartRadio app. It'll be posted by Cameron soon after the show is completed. And don't forget, speaking of podcasts, the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. It comes out every Tuesday and Friday, and you can download that wherever you get your podcasts, including the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, all those places. Thank you for listening and downloading that. I appreciate it. Thank you, Cameron, back at the station for running the board. And we'll do it again next week with the KFBK Garden Show from 8 to 10. And then Get Growing here on KSTE from 10 until noon. And don't forget the KSTE Farm Hour, which is coming up next. Have yourself a great week. Hopefully the smoke won't be with us next week. Well, we'll see. Good luck.